This afternoon, we have two speakers, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Professor David Cantor. He has actually developed the discipline of investigative psychology, and he is the director of the International Research Center for Investigative Psychology at the University of Huddersfield, where he also runs an MSc in the subject. David has worked with the police since 85, and he has been assisting in many criminal investigations, including some very, very high-profile ones. Primarily, he's an academic and an author, of many books. He had a popular book called Criminal Shadows, which won an award, and he also produced a television series called Mapping Murder, which then resulted in another book. And this was a six-part television documentary. And he recently has published a textbook, textbook called Investigative Psychology, Offender Profiling, and the Analysis of Criminal Behavior. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming David and his presentation, please.
Well, thank you very much for mentioning all those books. I couldn't have put it better myself. I was very pleased to be invited to talk to such an august gathering on such a challenging topic as criminal intention and conscious and unconscious motivation, because just about every word in that title is a word that I tell my students they must never use. The whole notion of intention and responsibility is such a fraught one, and the whole issue of motivation in particular is a very very difficult one. And there's some very interesting examinations of the whole concept of motivation to suggest that we only use the term motive when we can't explain what people are doing, and we search then desperately for a motive. So I was keen to have the opportunity to try and present perhaps a different way of thinking about these issues, but particularly in relation to what I personally have found to be quite a challenging and often fraught relationship between what psychologists have to do and what the law requires of them. And at the heart of my presentation today is an attempt to try and argue that, in a sense, both sides of this attempt at bridging, both sides have problems in dealing with the other, not because of any weaknesses in their particular disciplines, but because of the very different reasons why they are there. And some time ago, I thought a rather interesting way of summarizing this is this whole notion of the in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Because I was, when you look back into the origins of that and its debate in the sciences of how anybody with any particular expertise becomes very special and significant. But then if you take the H.G. Wells story that I was very taken with as a child, in which the one-eyed man goes into the kingdom of the blind, and they eventually decide he must be mad, and because he's talking about all these things that none of them have any relationship to or can see at all, and their story ends by them deciding the only way in which they can make him a part of their society is by actually blinding him. Hopefully I can leave it up to you to decide if we're talking about the law and psychology, which is the one-eyed man and which is the kingdom of the blind. Because I think I think a lot of the issues that are exploring today really come from these very different ways of trying to get to grips with what the different institutions are doing. Just to summarise the whole point of it is that it's clearly the case that the the courts and the whole exploration of criminal intent takes us back to the individual case and the details of that case and those particular circumstances. That's what we expect of the law and of many clinical practices, that we deal with the individual. We deal with them as a person, as somebody operates within society, who has intentions, responsibilities, and we've already had some very interesting quotes earlier on that the whole set of issues that we're dealing with come out of dealing with the person that we're as a person, as a fully involved social human being. And one of the things that I'd like to argue is the way we make sense of people and their lives and their activities is by looking at the personal narratives that they're part of. And although the learned judge talked a lot about the nuances of the law, I would argue, and I hope to give you some examples of this, I would argue that what actually happens in court is that there is an attempt to determine whether the underlying narrative of the case is plausible, and that the whole argument of the legal process is built around trying to disentangle what the major actors are, what they're doing within the context and the understanding of the narrative, what the key episodes are, and really looking at the individuals as having agency, driving forward the understanding of what their life stories are about. And I would argue that in a sense, this is totally at variance with what the psychological sciences and indeed the medical sciences, the biological sciences are dealing with, because the sciences deal with trends. They deal with underlying processes. I mean, one simple definition of science is to talk of science being ways of going beyond the data, that you have a particular set of data and out of it you draw principles that are then relevant to other circumstances, other situations, where you may have totally different data. And that's the purpose of science, and that's the value of science and how science operates. But in our context, what it tends to be doing, we're not dealing with people at all, we're dealing with organisms, we're dealing with causal processes that essentially are outside of the individual's control. That's the way we try to think of it, whether or not it's genetic or biological or upbringing or social circumstances. All of these are attempts to, I see it as a sort of turf war. They're all attempts to buy the sciences to say, no, this is our problem. It's not a problem of the law and of legal judgments. It's a problem of us as clinicians, as scientists, to explain what that person is doing and why they're doing it. And therefore, we're dealing very much with forces beyond the individual. We're dealing with that entity as an organism, and that's why there comes the problems of trying to relate these two different ways of explaining things to each other. And the law in particular, in my experience, and I think we saw some illustration of this earlier on, is what the law will do is to say to the sciences, the medical sciences, the psychological sciences, to psychiatrists, will say, if you're prepared to tell us that this is not a full person, then we'll let you, we'll let your judgment of the individual be acceptable. But otherwise, this is our territory, and we're making the decision about their intention, their responsibilities. So we're giving a very small slice of the decision-making process. And, of course, within the realms of particularly forensic psychiatry, the trick is to say, yeah, it's a medical problem, this individual. If it's a psychosis, then perhaps we can shun some particular influence. But of course, the vast majority of psychotics are far more dangerous to themselves than anybody else. And so there is a question why some schizophrenics go and kill and other schizophrenics don't. That doesn't enter into a lot of the considerations in the court, because it's a medical problem. You're telling us that the individual is not fully human, and therefore we're prepared to accept that judgment will come into the system. And it was why I raised the question earlier about psychopathy. I mean, I've actually worked on behalf of some psychopaths in their defense, and they're extreme psychopaths or sociopaths or personality disordered or borderline personality disorder, whatever term you want to pull out of a hat. They are very strange individuals, but it seems to me very odd to put them into the same category as somebody who, say, has had very serious severe brain damage or who has a very obvious psychotic illness that probably has some sort of fairly obvious genetic basis to it. It's because it's been medicalized that it's been an acceptable term. And what I'm trying to argue is that we should perhaps be trying to look to psychology and the other psychological sciences to try and enrich the narratives that the law will work with, and the different perspectives that the law will operate with. And in doing that, we've got to address some of these fundamental problems in the terminology that is what today is about, dealing with issues like intention and motivation, and whether an individual has conscious control over their actions and so on. These are things that we need to get to grips with. And what really brings this home to me, and that I shall use as I hope you don't mind the vivid graphics. I thought after lunch, you know, when people are nodding off, if we can keep it reasonably lively visually, it may help. There's a case that, most of you involved in forensic work will probably recognize the fact that if you're involved in any serious cases, they never seem to go away. There's always some extra bits and pieces, some appeal or some issue about the individual that comes to the fore. And there's a case that has dogged me for probably 15 years now that I think illustrates very clearly this issue that I'm dealing with about the different perspectives, particularly because this is a case in which my evidence was not allowed. Some of you may know about it. It still irks me that when I prepared a case for the third appeal for Eddie Guilfoyle, an appeal that was being presented by Mike Mansfield, a very distinguished barrister in the Court of Appeal, I still wasn't allowed to, although they debated my report, I wasn't allowed to point out that they'd misunderstood some of the issues and that I had to sit behind Mike Mansfield, which those of you who know me will realize it's a terribly difficult thing for me to achieve. But they dealt with this. But it's a fascinating case, and I think it does bring home a lot of the issues. But in its essence, Paula Guilfoyle was found hanging in her garage, and a suicide note was found. To keep it as simple as possible, Eddie Guilfoyle, her husband, was convicted of her murder. This was in 1992. She was 8.5 months pregnant, and part of the issue was, would a woman who was that pregnant kill herself? There was no indication in her contact with people out and about around the family that she was in any way depressed or upset about the baby. She'd actually arranged for the christening. She'd got two prams because one was going to be kept at her parents, who were going to help look after the baby, so the essential narrative here was to try and challenge the idea of a woman at that stage in pregnancy without any overt indications of concern killing herself. She left this suicide note that I've studied on and off for many years, that to anybody reading it, I don't think will have any difficulty seeing it as a suicide note. I've decided to put an end to everything, don't say end a chapter in my life. one of the themes of the note is that Eddie is not to blame himself for this, that this is Paula's decision. And the second page of Good Night and God Bless, I apologize for all the pain and suffering I've caused by taking my own life. By the way, this was presented to me. This is a direct copy of the photocopy that was given to me by the police, and the bits that were cut off at the side. This is the sort of material that many of you will have seen in these sorts of cases. So the question was, this is a clear suicide note. The body was found inside a locked garage, hanging. We could spend hours discussing this case. One of the things that I did eventually, after I'd actually met Eddie and talked to him about the whole set of circumstances, was to look through all the material that was available in relation to the case and produce this report concerning a very detailed report. And one of the central problems that emerges here, and I think this is an issue, again, at the heart of what we're talking about, is that the person actually on trial here is not Eddie, but Paula. Because what you're trying to do is determine whether or not Paula was going to kill herself. The background story, and this is where the narrative issue becomes very interesting, and why definitely when I get around to writing my novel, this will be at the heart of it. The background story was that Eddie had been having an affair with another woman who was called Sandra. Therefore, he had somehow or other dictated this note to Paula, got her to write it. And then he had talked her into going in into the garage and putting her head in the noose, as part of what was claimed was him needing to get some material to talk about at an evening class he was doing as a paramedic, in which he was looking at suicide. I mean, I'm skating over the details. As I say, it's a full novel in its own right. No two ways about it. But the background storyline then that was never tested in court. In other words, this was claimed as the basis for what had gone on. That he talked Paula into putting her head in the noose, then lifted her legs up and put them onto a ladder, thereby strangling her being hung. One of the things that I did that had not happened in the original case was to look through the whole correspondence that there had been between them, because actually they'd been on different shifts and there had been some difficulties in their relationship. They were doing up their house and they were leaving notes for each other. And what there were 11 notes that unfolded the storyline of Paula being ever more upset about her relationship, implying she'd had a relationship with somebody else, that the baby was somebody else's, and that the person who had who was the father of the baby had actually abandoned her and gone away, and that she didn't see any other way forward. That's the narrative that unfolds from these series of letters. But the court wouldn't allow me to put that in place because the court was dealing with the individual. I was not in a position to say that Paula was mentally ill or disturbed in some way, which would have allowed the court then to form a judgment about whether she was likely to commit suicide. They took evidence from 14 people, all of whom said how happy she was. Eddie didn't give evidence. Was advised not to give evidence, this whole process was never tested. It was on the other hand, the much simpler and much more graphic novel was that Eddie basically was a very clever guy who had dictated the suicide note to Paula to write out, and that then she had And then he had tricked her into hanging herself. And that was the implicit story that the court was working with, although they were doing it around evidence from various witnesses and so on. And it really brought home to me that this difficulty that because the courts will only allow a psychological analysis around the notion of some sort of mental disturbance, around the idea that the individual either has responsibility or not, and feed that into a plausible narrative, this sort of examination that is a more of a sort of social psychological behavioral examination of an alternative plausible narrative was not really allowed by the process, and Eddie Guilfoyle is still in prison all those years later. And it really opens up the issue that if the court is looking for motives and looking for conscious responsibility, how complex this can all become. So one of the things that we've started to explore is the sorts of explanations that people give for their crimes and, interestingly, for their desistance from crime. And this, again, I think helps us to unravel the whole idea of motive and to show that motive doesn't really get us very far in terms of understanding criminal behavior and criminal intention. And one of the things that we did was to interview a number of individuals who claimed they'd given up their life of crime, and to discuss with them the reasons why, what sort of aspects of their life had led to them desisting from crime, a word obviously invented by the Americans to describe the process. And I'm now going to start presenting you with some statistical analyses. But the statistical analyses I first became interested in when I started off actually as a psychologist in a school of architecture. And they produce results in a very visual way, which architects are very comfortable with, although behind it is some quite sophisticated statistics. And so what we did with these 58 people was to draw up a sort of content dictionary, as we call it, a list of components of what they had referred to as being of significance in them giving up the criminal activities. And this process is then put through a statistical procedure that allows us to represent each of these reasons as a point in space, and the closer together any two reasons are, the more likely are they to co-occur, the more likely is the same person to have referred to them. So we end up with a diagram like this, that, as I say, is pretty easy to make sense of. That, for instance, somebody who said that there was pressure from their partner was also likely to refer to being married or to having some partner or having kids. Those things are likely to have co-occur, but they're not so likely to occur in terms of issues in relation to health or some other sort of crisis that the individual had, or the fact that they were just getting older and they felt it was beyond them. And what we can do is we can try and form some interpretation of this by just looking at the different regions of that. That helps us to develop an idea of the broad reasons that individuals have. So the one set of reasons is that they've changed, in effect, they've changed their account of themselves, their personal narrative, that they were no longer thinking of themselves as criminals, but they were thinking of themselves as having responsibilities and through children particularly as needing to get beyond that whole criminal process. Another reason was that their relationship, we sometimes say in a slightly un-PC way, that when these criminals find a good woman, that helps them out of crime. But certainly that relationship is another sort of part of the process. And sometimes it's close. It's authority figures, or the fact that they've suffered some severe experience as part of the criminal activity that has frightened them, or in particular issues to do with health, or the fear of what's going to happen to them next because they've been arrested and in prison. One of the interesting, this process of analysis enables us to take a lot of different issues, a lot of different ideas, and show that they're all part of a range of different styles and ways of, as I've suggested, reconstructing their understanding of what they are and who they are, of developing a new life story. And the examples that were given earlier today are successful with offenders, for instance, making them part of a musical activity, part of an orchestra or a band, gives them a whole change in their identity, or beginning to work with their partner in terms of trying to achieve certain objectives in their lives, again, changes that personal narrative. But I think the problem that this raises about the notion of motive is where are these? These are about changes in the way the individual deals with the world and the relationships they have to others and the way they understand themselves. A much more complex bundle of ways of acting and of processes than would be true if we were talking about this sort of classic fictional idea of particular motives for crime, whether it's greed or power or vengeance or any of those other sorts of explanations that can be given. They only make sense when we embed them in these understandings of these sorts of narratives. And what I would like to do in order to develop this idea is to look more look in more detail at the actions the criminals carry out, because that's what a lot of what we've been doing within the realms of investigative psychology is to look in detail at what they actually do and try to understand what their actions tell us about the implicit narratives that are part of the whole criminal activity. And the case that first brought me into this in the mid-1980s and actually changed my life, I think illustrates very well how we can begin to understand the process that the offender is part of that takes us beyond this idea of particular mental disturbances or some of the other much more simple-minded explanations of crime that often are what goes on in the legal context. There were a series of rapes and murders carried out across London in 1982 to 1986. Again, we could go on at great length about this, but this was a map that the police had produced of where these had occurred. I was asked for a very sort of roundabout contacts, and again, a whole other story that is told in detail in my book, Criminal Shadows, that's not actually very easily available. You can get the American translation. There is indeed an American translation that's a third shorter. We took all the jokes out and the sort of irony and stuff. You can get that from American Amazon, but it's a bit of a collector's item, the original English version. So I'll just go through that. But I was asked, basically, they had linked a number of two murders into this whole pattern of rapes. And the police asked me whether I could... They said to me, can you help us catch this man before he kills again? And you don't say, well, I'm actually a bit busy at the moment. Having had no contact with the police at all, except for something that happened when I was 16, but I tell you that over. I won costs against the police. I just took a very simple, almost social psychological perspective on this, not having coming from a clinical background and looking at these individuals as disturbed, but just dealing with them as a criminal, as a person, as a, if you like, a normal member of society who is breaking the rules. But they're going to be trying to achieve the same sort of things as anybody else. And just looking at the pattern of behavior, one of the interesting things, there was a development in the behavior over time. To begin with, there were two offenders involved, and it tended to be happening at the weekend. But then there was one offender, and it was happening during the week, and it seemed to be more planned and more determined. So there seemed to be a growth into this role of being the criminal, starting off with something that almost seemed to be, it's the wrong term, but sort of recreational, something that was happening not as a direct part of the individual's view of himself, but something that became ever more committed and ever more involved. And on the basis of that, and looking at just the details of his behaviour, I produced what I would never do now, a profile, because this has become such an area of mythology that it's a very... It's an area that is totally misunderstood. I do like to say to audiences, how do you know what profound psychological process do you think we used to find out that he had light hair and he was probably about 5'9" and right-handed? Yes, from the witness statements, people often try and come up with all sorts of... One of the things that we decided to do was just to systematize all the information the police had, because they had it in all sorts of different groups. But there are a couple of things in there that turned out to be quite important. One of them, that he had had a previous relationship, but it was probably a tempestuous one. And at that stage, that was regarded as quite a novel suggestion. You know, this is a nasty guy going around raping and killing people. The chances are he's known to be quite a nasty guy who has probably had some violent relationship. In those days, the notion of what was dismissed as a domestic, that there was that somebody who had attacked his ex-wife or a girlfriend or whatever, would be dismissed by the police as saying, well, you know, that's not the sort of person who goes out on the streets and rapes and murders. Whereas my argument would be that's exactly the sort of person who would, if he can get away with it. And one of the individuals in the police trawl had come into their notice because he was he'd been accused of assaulting his ex-wife. The other intriguing issue that we discovered was the location we suggested where he'd been living. And what I got the police to do, and this came out of my background working in studying people, how people make sense of places and how they come to understand their environments. One of the things we did was just to look at where the crimes had occurred at different points in time. And it was around London, and the early crimes had occurred in this area of northwest London. And there was nothing in the police records for 1983. These were the crimes in 84, and then 85, 86. And then the murders occurred at the edge of this. And given the development in the behaviour, putting that against the development in the whole spatial growth led to the suggestion that those early crimes were, as I say, where the individual was less committed to a life of crime, less involved and determined to carry out these crimes, it likely to be something happening very much in terms of where he was, based locally, and that indeed was where the home was of one of the individuals that the police were looking at, and so that gave the police the basis for focusing on this individual much more carefully, putting surveillance teams on the individual, and then eventually collecting the evidence that came to a conviction. And this was John Duffy. The photograph on your right is the photograph of him when he was arrested for assaulting his wife. The photograph on the left was when he was arrested for these rapes and murders. One of the problems with this sort of research is that you have this hypothesis about the development and the growth of the process, and that we're dealing with somebody developing an idea of himself as a rapist, as a criminal. That you can wait a long time to get any more supporting corroborative evidence. And Duffy, in particular, claimed that he had amnesia. And he didn't remember anything to do with the crimes. But when he'd been in prison for 14 years and apparently deeply into counselling, it all came back to him that actually, yes, he did remember, and it was his mate, Dave Mulcahy, who had actually committed the murders, which Mulcahy strenuously denies. The important point for us at the moment is that he then described 14 years later, in court, to begin, it was areas we knew well, we would plan it quite meticulously. We used to call it hunting, and it was a bit of a joke. And then you get into a pattern, it's difficult to stop. In other words, it becomes part of your lifestyle, part of what you're involved in. And so we got some confirmation years later of the hypothesis we developed from looking at his behaviour. And this is the sort of thing we've now begun to develop in a number of other ways. But before I go on a little bit further to illustrate that, the way we've been exploring criminal narratives, I do want to touch on the issue of the unconscious as part of this, and the idea that somehow or other we can build into legal considerations the aspects of the individual's secret fantasy life. Because there's a very now very well-known case in which Rachel Kell was murdered on Wimbledon Common. She was there with her 2-year-old son and a dog. The police determined that Colin Stagg must have been the person who had carried out that crime, and they set up a situation where a police officer pretended to be a young woman interested in a relationship with a man who had committed violent crimes and developed contact with Colin Stagg and tried to get him to admit to the crimes. And somebody who called himself a forensic psychologist advised the police on this. And claimed that within a few weeks, Colin Stagg would basically admit to it. 6 months into this undercover operation, Colin Stagg still hadn't admitted to this activity, to anything really relating to the murder. But nonetheless, the forensic psychologist was prepared to go into court and say that Colin Stagg's fantasies were the fantasies of the person who had committed the crime. Now, how anybody can tell what somebody's fantasies are from the way a body has been left is you know, really open to an awful lot of question. And certainly the violent attack on an individual in an open place, it would be a reasonable assumption that somebody was obviously very disturbed, psychologically disturbed, who had carried out that attack, which Colin Stagg certainly wasn't. I interviewed him for his defence and prepared some of the material challenging what the forensic psychologist had done, and Colin Stagg certainly wasn't mentally disturbed in any way. He was one of life's losers in a way, because he sort of misunderstood the whole situation, and he'd tell the police he wasn't on the common when he was, because he was afraid what would happen and all these sorts of things. But he certainly wasn't the sort of disturbed individual you would have expected from a very simple consideration of the nature of the crime. But the point was that he was in prison for 11 months and that the waiting trial, and that this psychologist was prepared to claim that Colin Stagg had indicated from his accounts of the fantasies he tried to invent for the undercover police officer, that he was indeed the individual. Fortunately, the judge, perhaps not very surprisingly, the judge threw this whole thing out. And in fact, there was a confidential memo that I saw from a senior police officer before this went to trial that actually said The judge will be spitting feathers when he sees this, which I thought was a very apposite account. The judge obviously was much more thoughtful, as we know judges can be, gave this very clear account. But it just shows the risk of trying to use these sorts of interpretations of the individual's inner state as part of a criminal process. So really, to sort of show you a little bit more of how we've been developing this further, and to give you a bit more grip on the whole idea of offenders' personal narratives. We've actually been interviewing offenders and getting them to tell us their life stories. And one of the central issues here is that these narratives are part of our culture. They are narratives that we can all draw on in different ways. There is an argument within the literary analysis of storylines that there's relatively few stories available to any particular culture, and that we draw out from these stories either tragedies or heroic activity or activities that imply that the individual is a victim of circumstances and so on. And I was very struck a little while ago by a newspaper article that really the individual in court quotes the narrative that he is hooking into. The dominant. It's a very strange use of the narrative. But he talks. I mean, he killed his child. He was going to kill himself, but it failed. And he says that it was like Romeo and Juliet. That's what he buys into, a very curious example. But this is the way he's trying to present himself and probably sees himself. And so there are these different sort of narratives that the individuals have. And I'll just illustrate that a little bit further. One of the things we've been doing is to ask offenders to describe their offence, what happened in their own terms, and then also to talk about other significant events in their lives, and also in order to try and understand how they present themselves, how they see themselves in a narrative context, to ask them, well, if somebody was going to make a film about your life, what sort of a film would it be? And you can even ask them who would act the part of you and what it would be like. What we've found actually is that, I mean, this whole area of what you might call narrative psychology is a growing area of psychology, but virtually all the work has been done with very capable, effective individuals. And in those studies, they say, if your life was a book, what would the main chapters be and so on? And who would the main individuals be in it, and how would it all unfold? And when you do this with very competent, capable people, you get very rich storylines. We found with offenders, this is actually very difficult, that part of their life is this disorganized, dysfunctional sort of way of dealing with the world that they have a hard time putting a grip on. And certainly the idea of a book is not something terribly clear to them. We found the notion of a film worked a little bit better. But actually, if I rush through, I'll show you we've actually started using questionnaires, because that's a lot easier, where we give them narrative roles and ask them which one describes their experiences of crime. But let me just show you a couple of examples. This is a 28-year-old convicted of murder. He said the significant event in his house is kids were using his house just to doss out, they really weren't doing, they weren't behaving themselves, they were making a mess, so he threw them out and battered them all, was his description. The murder he describes as an individual who insulted him as a party, and he felt he couldn't let him get away with that, and that he beat him up, and in fact he beat him up very viciously and dumped him in a dustbin. And this murderer's account of it ends with what does not seem to be an ironic statement. He says, that really messed my night up. And when you ask him about the film, he comes up with this great heroic film of dishing out punishment for wrongdoing. So it clearly indicates that there's a consistency about this underlying view of himself as a hero who is fighting against the bad guys and keeping them under control. And really any attempt to really work with this individual so he's not more violent would need to get to grips with this sort of aspect. And it seems to me intention, conscious issues, those things seem to me don't really get to grips with what this individual's life is about and how his understanding of himself is actually leading him into these criminal situations. Here's another example of a 24-year-old who describes showing off to some girls when he was a young teenager and hurting himself very badly and how he had to be very careful not to show he was hurt. And he actually murdered his son because his son was insulting him and teasing him because he actually was out of work and he wasn't able to bring any money into the house. And his son wouldn't listen to him. And the film idea, he talks about a cub turning into a full-grown man, about a growing-up story of becoming a more significant and effective individual. So, and he was very keen to say that it would be the sort of film that would win a lot of Oscars. So he's seeing himself very much as an individual who has to defend his pride and his significance and has to sort of present himself in the world as an important and relevant and individual. And I think these just help to illustrate the ways in which this idea of the narrative actually does have quite strong roots and can be worked. I mean, there is a whole development of what's known as narrative therapy, where you work with individuals to try and get them to reconstruct their previous life story so that they can see their future as being different. I'll skip this serial rapist stuff, as exciting as it is, and just finally talk about the way we've been taking this further and to show you how these narratives really hook into popular culture, which is by giving offenders questionnaires and asking them to indicate how much each of these statements describes their experiences, in fact, in this case, while committing a crime. I mean, this is looking much more directly at the actual criminal activity. And these statements come out of our interviews with offenders about the sort of things that they thought they would do and that they... It's a way of summarizing a narrative. We call it the roles questionnaire because it presents a whole series of different roles the individual would play, the idea being that the role is an encapsulation of a narrative. It's a 33-item questionnaire. And there's all sorts of issues in it. Everything, you know, it was like a usual day's work. I remember interviewing one prolific burglar saying that, you know, all the excitement had gone out of it. He just sort of went out in the morning and sort of burgled a few houses and to get some money and sort of get on with things. As opposed to other individuals who see themselves very much driven to take revenge or feeling that it's just part of the fates of what they get caught up in. And so on. So again, we put it through the same sort of analysis as before, where we look at the co-occurrence of these different roles, so that an individual who felt he just wasn't part of it was just sort of nothing too special, is part would go together, whereas these things about it being a usual day's work, routine, it all went to plan, and those would co-occur, but very unlikely to occur with the feeling of being a victim. And, I mean, we've got quite an involved analysis of all this in some publications, hooking it into various ideas of interpersonal relationships and how people see themselves. But I just wanted to show you that you get these groupings of ways of seeing yourself that really can be taken back into the dominant narratives that characterize our lives, for instance, on a mission and seeing themselves, they couldn't stop. It was a manly thing to do, as opposed to they really didn't care what was going on. Nothing else mattered. I just had to sort of carry out the revenge. And this whole interesting grouping of being a professional, just doing a job. But there is a subset there of individuals who find it very exciting, that whole process. And then this helpless, confused victim individual who often these will be the individuals involved in violent assaults, whereas these will be much more of the property crimes and the burglars who see that they're doing a day's work and it's really what they do. And that's what their life is about, and getting them to reconstruct their lives so that they no longer think of themselves in those ways, as I suggested earlier on, relates to the relationships and the social processes that they're part of, and of course, importantly, relates to whether they've got a job or not, which is a slightly semi-political comment given what's in the news at the moment. I've tried to outline for you this idea that if we take human agency as a characteristics of human beings, and it's the sort of thing that as people in the psychological sciences ought to be getting to grips with, then there is a way of enriching our understanding of criminal behavior that could have implications for the law, but which really takes us away from a medicalization of what it is that we ought to be doing when we're looking at individuals. So I hope I've introduced you to that, hopefully, somewhat controversial issue. And we'd be happy to deal with questions. Thank you.
Thank you. That was truly interesting, David. So I guess that by constructing a narrative around the events that lead to a particular crime, you look at the inevitability of things going the way they do. It's a shame that Roger Tolson is not here, sure. But I'm just wondering whether by seeing the case in its bigger context, whether that, in effect, will alter dramatically the view of the court and of the jury on whether a particular individual who has committed a crime or not, the intention behind it, whether that is then altered in the light of a narrative like this.
Well, I think what we're trying to do is that the various lawyers, barristers involved, are trying to convince the jury of what is a plausible explanation. If they can bring in some apparently strong medical evidence, and that fits in with the jury's understanding of what a plausible storyline is. If the jury doesn't actually understand some of the complexities of human understanding of ourselves and how we operate, then the barristers don't get that storyline across. I mean, the first case that I mentioned, the judge wouldn't allow any evidence suggesting that people can kill themselves without there being any clear indication to others around them that they were thinking of doing so. I actually published a paper trying to get the notion of secret despair syndrome around, because you talk to any people in the clinical area and they'll tell you plenty of examples of people who kill themselves, and everybody around them says, we don't know why they did it, we never knew it was going to happen. But the judge said and in the appeal courts said, oh yeah, people can tell that, people know those sorts of issues. So in other words, people are hooking into a very simple narrative of suicide without understanding the much richer picture. And that in a sense is what we're trying to get toward. But it's terribly difficult because in a sense, the courts hold on to the idea that they know what the plausible narratives are, and they're only allowing us to say, to chip away at bits of it.
Mm. Interesting. Questions?
You mentioned when you construct a narrative of a, quote, normal, unquote, person, the story is very rich. I'm just wondering if you've done any analysis of doing some stories and narratives of ordinary people, you know, just leading ordinary lives, with these people, and any qualitative analysis between those two.
Well, there is published a lot, there's a growing literature of normal people's accounts of their lives. That we can compare our offenders' accounts with. And also we do have some data where we did, precisely because of the need for that comparison, of looking at those issues. What seems to happen, and it may be, you know, the problem with the problem with getting somebody to give an account of their lives is that the context in which that account is given will shape the nature of the narrative, and that's the whole study of narratives. It's who the audience is influences the way the narrative is presented. So there are problems there. But taking that aside, what happens with criminals is that their narratives are about their crimes. I mean, you can talk to somebody who tells you, I was arrested for this, and when I was eight, I got into trouble for this, and then I spent some time doing this. And they will never mention, for instance, that they got their MBQ in bricklaying in one prison, and that they that actually held a job down as a computer programmer or whatever in another, that their lives are structured, they are told they are criminals and their lives are structured around that process. If you do it with students, it's obvious, they will tell you the exams they passed and they will tell you about their achievements in that sort of way. So I think, I mean, this is what comes out of it, is that people's, you know, it's what people emphasize, what people distill out of their experiences, that seems to be the what we're picking up here.
I've come interested in the whole debate between the narrative structure and diagnostic medical labels and the conflict between them. I mean, I'm involved now in setting up a Asperger's service in Westminster, part of the autistic bill that came out, and usually I'm very sceptical about further kind of diagnostic labels covering all, but now I'm seeing particular relevance to, I mean, some of the examples there, I thought, I wonder if this guy had Asperger's, you know, it covers the whole narrative. The narrative's now out of the question. I don't know quite what I'm asking, but I'm caught in that struggle between the relevance of a diagnostic label, which actually is interesting and reframes a person's life in many different ways, if you think of it as, say, a developmental disorder, which has never been seen because we've only seen the narrative of the difficult background they've had. So I'm just kind of caught between...
Is your background as a medic, is it?
I'm a psychiatrist at the moment. Oh, previously, I was a psychotherapist, so that's also between the narrative and the diagnostic.
Yeah, well, DSM and the whole sort of bundle of diagnoses, clearly the courts are quite comfortable with it. My sort of experimental scientific psychology background throws its hands up in horror, if a background can do that, at DSM. And that it is so, that these diagnostic categories are masquerading for all sorts of things, ethical judgments, confusions about origins, ideas about pseudo evolutionary or pseudo biomedical explanations of things. And I keep on, you know, you keep on coming against the central point that, you know, two people of his Asperger's will be very different. Okay, so it's a great range of diagnoses. So where does that take you? And you can pick the one that you want. I mean, the worst one for my money is personality disorder, because as a psychologist who's a lecturer on personality, I just do not understand what it means for a personality to be disordered. But when we take it into the legal context, you also get the even richer complexity of the fact that, for instance, the whole thing from MacNaughton onwards about in insanity defence is it's a disease of the mind. It's not a disease of the brain. And people can have brain disease without being morally problematic and vice versa. So this whole business of hooking psychological states. I mean, this is a turf war. I'm quite open about that. As a social psychologist, I want to claim this as part of social psychology and understanding of the way people deal with the world. Psychiatrists who come out of a strongly medical, pharmaceutical background want to claim, oh, no, we own this because it's all about brain sub-hemorrhages that we can't actually measure, but there's something going on in the brain or it's genetic. I always tell my friends, if the medics can't explain it, it's either genetic, it's a virus, or it's psychosomatic. Clearly there are extremes. There's no doubt about it. There are extremes where people are very, very disturbed, and you can put a very direct sort of finger on what the organic problem is. But beyond that, it seems to me the diagnosis is of value for the institutions because it summarizes things and makes everything simpler, and it gives a way out of dealing with some of the complexities that the judge mentioned earlier. But it doesn't actually convince psychologically that is actually explaining anything.
Hello, my name is Tracy Logan. I'm a science journalist and I'm here for background research. I was really interested in your first set of statistics where you were talking about the reasons, when you were talking about how people saw their crimes, you know, and there was that big chunk of people who really saw their crimes as a workaday sort of thing, and they were like harvesting almost.
Yeah.
A sense of, I mean, in the context of this discussion meeting, the sense of criminal responsibility. And especially what you said afterwards about how people talk about their time in prison, and you know, they seemed to be in a sort of denial as to whether they were sort of criminals at all in a way, or whether it was a bad thing they were doing. And I wondered, as a psychologist working in this area, how far it's possible to actually turn someone's mind around and make them see that maybe what they're doing is antisocial, how far is that possible?
Well, it depends on the individual, of course, and the particular situation. But the idea of being a criminal is very interesting because one of the roles we have is the role of criminal. And quite a lot of the people we interviewed in prison don't assign that role to themselves. And that role actually often ends up in an area that relates to violence rather than in the sort of professional area of activity. So the notion of being a criminal is something that criminals themselves explore and have a view on, and many of them will say, I'm not really a criminal, I never hurt anybody, or I'm not really a criminal, I never robbed anybody, I've only beaten people up when I got angry, I'm not a criminal. So there is a very real view of that, and of course a lot of the interventions with offenders is trying to get them to say, well, hang on, whether you call it criminal or not, it's just not the way society is prepared to accept your behaviour, and you've got to find a way around it. And one of the ways of dealing with people who in a sense are denying that they're criminal is to say to them, well, actually, do you want to spend the rest of your life in prison? Whether you're calling it criminal or not, can we work with you to help you not do things that will actually lead to you being put in prison again, and trying to work with them in that way. Of course, what may be happening in many of these things, many of these training sessions, is you're actually making them much more able not to get caught. And so they don't come back into prison because they're much more sophisticated. That's very difficult to disentangle. But that certainly is, although it's often not recognised as that, my understanding is that that's the essence of what you're often trying to do with these individuals. You're trying to change their view of what their role is in society.
Hi. There's a growing wave of people who are involved with restorative justice and various things in prison that are being organised by chaplaincy, where they get victims in a South Africa-type court. Do you have any thoughts on these movements and the link with your work?
Oh, yes. If it's handled effectively, then it can It can, with certain individuals, there's no doubt, it can change their understanding of what they're doing and what the consequences of what they're doing are. A lot of criminality grows out of believing that nobody really suffers. But clearly there are plenty of individuals who don't care what other people suffer, so it can be problematic. And in fact, I edit a journal that is a social science journal, and we've just got a whole issue on post-conflict societies where they've been looking at precisely these sorts of things, and the social scientists studying them say that they're not nearly as effective as the public relations issues would indicate, and that these, what you have is this seething, as we can see in Northern Ireland, you have this seething set of problems that aren't actually being dealt with by truth commissions and reconciliation commissions and so on, because there are some fundamental social and psychological issues that are not being addressed. So, like all of these things, it's good in parts. I mean, I think a lot of these restorative justice activities can be very helpful, and you can give people insights. One of my favourite fan letters after the three or four I've ever received it was from a violent man in a South African prison who said he'd read my book Criminal Shadows and that he'd realised he'd always thought of himself as a victim, and he was now trying to move through beyond that. You know, that's great. If those sorts of insights can actually help people, it obviously depends on the individual, but it certainly can for some individuals.
Sorry, Eric Abrams. I sense actually quite a profound aspect to what you've given us today, because you've given us almost a third leg to two aspects of criminality. One is pathologizing or punishing. You've come up with something that is actually different in terms of rehabilitation and so on, and I think it's profound in the sense of its ability to work outside of those two systems. At the moment, I can see that you're working within that, within those two branches or legs. But actually, I think you're possibly pointing to a different way of dealing with our concept of criminality.
Well, that's the intention, and so thank you for those comments. And in particular, what I'm trying to hold on to is the notion of human agency. In other words, these individuals are responsible for the personal narratives they create. I'm desperately trying to avoid implying it's some sort of yet another personality system and yet another diagnostic system, that this is an individual who has got a heroism complex or something like that. I'm desperately trying to avoid that and to say that people build an account of themselves that they are responsible for, and that's what the courts are dealing with to some degree, and that's what we're trying to deal with in rehabilitation, and that's what we're trying to hold on to, so that we're never in any way exonerating these individuals, but we're trying to understand what they are doing with their lives and how they are pushing that forward, and using the same sorts of models as we would use with all sorts of other people in all sorts of other contexts. If you say to somebody, if you really want to be a doctor, then you've got to understand what is involved in being a doctor. If you want to be a novelist, you've got to understand that you're going to have a lot of rejection slips and you're going to have to keep on writing. I'm quoting the guy who set up the creative writing course at East Anglia, who was saying, you know, the key thing he had to do with his students was to get them to be prepared to take on the role of the novelist. It was nothing to do with skills, it was to do with how they hooked into the personal narrative. So it's an idea that is relevant right across the board, and all I'm trying to say is that it's relevant to taking on the role of a criminal as well.
Thank you very much, David. Let's put our hands together too.